It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 28th of October.
You're listening to Today with John Timpson and Brian Redhead.
From John Timpson and Libby Purvis.
You're listening to Today with Jenny Murray and Peter Hobday.
This is Today with James Naughtie and Sue McGregor.
This is Today with Edward Starton and James Naughtie.
This is Today with Evan Davis and Justin Webb.
This is Today with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein.
Good morning, and this really is Today. Today, with Sarah Montague and John Humphreys, 60 years to the day since this programme was first broadcast.
And this morning, we're broadcasting from the Wigmore Hall in London, looking back at the last six decades in the company of some very special guests, from the Sublime to the quite extraordinary.
Knock and knock and down, that's it. Stretch more, up, twice overhead, twice down to your sides.
Eileen Fowler there, leading the Today programme's daily exercise slot in the 1970s. The headlines this morning. The Spanish government has moved to take direct control of Catalonia after the regional parliament. It's 40 minutes past seven. Well, this morning, to mark our 60th anniversary, we are broadcasting in front of an audience in the Wigmore Hall in London. Now, during the decades that we've been on air, BBC journalists have reported from all around the world. And here is one now, one you'll know very well, Justin Webb, with his take on how things have changed in that time. Justin.
Sarah, thank you. Today is, of course, about a lot more than domestic politics. It's always been a window on the whole world, a place for BBC reporters to bring their news to people in Britain who care about, who know about the world. And I spent most of my career doing that, though I follow in the footsteps of many great reporters, including, of course, John, but also, rather oddly, my own father, Peter Woods, who became famous as a newsreader in the 1970s, but was before that a war reporter. And here he is, in Berlin, the day the wall went up in 1961.
As threats and counter-threats go on over this torn city, the Iron Curtain running through Berlin has today become a cement wall. I've come to the wedding district, a notoriously tough area, to see the effect of the East German government decision to seal off its people from the Western Zone. And what a grim picture it makes. Inside streets only 100 yards from this barricade, a group of 10 Russian T-34 tanks are lurking. The steel-helmeted East German police guarding the barricade have already pointed their guns at us in a threatening way when they saw our camera. Early today, I watched workmen supervised by troops putting the finishing touches to the cement curtain, through which no East German can pass.
Well, there we are, the delivery, not quite what you'd expect on Today these days. Too stilted, perhaps too unconversational. And I think the same is probably true of my own reporting from decades ago.
Shortly after radio confirmation of success was received, the tornadoes themselves glided out of the dawn sky. They had taken part in the first attacks, telling physical evidence of Britain's commitment to the war effort. For the young airman, a taste of fear and exhilaration. Later on in the day, as further sorties were flown, the news came that one plane and its two-man crew was missing. Proof, if it were needed, that the air war is not an easy or painless option.
The tornadoes will almost certainly be back in action tonight. They're pleased with what they've done so far, but there's a long way to go before their difficult work is over. Justin Webb, BBC News, Eastern Saudi Arabia.
That was 1991. Since then, we've become a little less gung-ho about our wars abroad, perhaps a little more used to the idea as well of Brits being in conflict. We've also begun to question each other on air more and expect clearer answers. In this exchange with Peter Sissons on the day the euro was introduced, I wish in retrospect that I'd gone a little bit further.
Justin, when will it be possible to judge whether the changeover has been a success?
Well, the short answer is not today, and not in a few days to come either. Although there is a positive mood, it really tells us nothing about the long-term future. We will only know whether this currency is a success when there is a severe economic shock in one Eurozone nation and the other nations rally round and the currency survives. That is sometime in the future. So a positive mood today, and that is helpful, but the jury is still out.
It's still the case, though, that big events need to be given weight on today, and still the case that those who report on those events are given an opportunity to look in. Let's face it, Westminster politics really isn't everything.
This man, if he chooses to, can change this country. That is the door that is open for him if he can walk through it.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
Well, there we are. Foreign reporting. Expensive is often difficult, but it's very much a part of this programme, and long may it remain the case.
And what about you, Justin? You want to go back on the road?
Well, what
you're
we
allowed
do
to speak. No, nobody's listening. That is the live audience here, by the way.
We combine the two, don't we? And I very much think we should continue to combine the two, because if we just sit, I mean, we're sitting rather oddly behind a table in a theatre this morning, but we just sit in a studio and we never meet anyone face to face or see anything face to face as a programme, then we're the less for it. So yeah, long
yep,
we go.
Yep, absolutely right. Thanks, Justin. The time is now 18 minutes past seven. Internships are the big thing these days for young
people. It is now 22 minutes past seven. We don't have our own songs on this programme, but back in the 60s, Sir Richard Stilgo used to sing a weekly song for us. It was usually about a subject that was too expensive for a reporter to be sent to cover. And rather appropriately on this, our 60th anniversary, Sir Richard is here, sitting at a marvellous grand piano on the stage here in the Wigmore Hall. And Sir Richard, what sort of subjects were you asked to sing about?
Unsurprisingly, almost exactly the same sort of subjects as now. Interest rates, productivity. In May 1967, 50 years ago, we were obsessed with Europe. But thank heavens that is all behind us now, thank heavens. Harold Wilson applied for the UK to join the EEC, and so I had to do a song about that. And most of it is incomprehensible now, but one verse 50 years ago went: this little country went to market, decided that Europe could be home. This little country went wee to the Treaty of Rome. And nothing much has changed since then, except you're very kind, there's worse to come. The BBC is now much more careful about what we say. So today I first thought of doing a Michel Barnier song. We need to know if Britain is going to pay the bill. We take Theresa out to dinner to find out if she will, Theresa won't, she doesn't want to say. It's never Theresa will or won't, it's always Theresa May. But of course I wouldn't be allowed to do that now. In any case, we have a packed programme ahead. Later we have Philip May, Philip Hammond, Philip Pullman, Philip Schofield, Philip Tufnell and Prince Philip, because we always end the programme with six pips, one of which lasts longer than the others. So I've chosen a really safe subject, not the pips, but this is a song about Gary's racing tips. I own a handsome racehorse, firm of shoulder, strong of shins, and frankly, the Tories will make sure that he wins. Sorry, that should be, and Frankie de Tory will make sure that he wins. He is rapid round the gallops, his eye is bright and steady, he is breeding, he is feeding well, the trainer says he's ready. Only one thing can prevent him winning glory on the course. Please, Gary, don't tip my horse. Please don't tip my racehorse, it's bound to end in sorrow. The horses you tip on today usually finish tomorrow. Last week you tipped Melania, that got you into trouble. She won and then the steward said she was a body double. The day that you tipped Weinstein, there was a noise like Babel. He never ran, just chased the other horses round the stable. I want to see my racehorse in the winner's frame, so please, Gary, don't say my horse's name. If you pick your name out the minute you have said it, my racehorse will be slower than a universal credit. Thursday's selection was a horse called Jeremy Hunt. Jim Nofty got its name wrong, so it never hit the front. On Friday, you chose... On Friday you chose Sterling, which then had a nasty fall, and Ryanair and Monarch, who didn't go at all. Please don't make my racehorse make the walk of shame. Please, Gary, don't say my horse's name. I haven't said my horse's name in case that really wrecks it. 'Cause if you say its name, it may just run straight for the exit. It's going well in training, every day the trainer checks it. But if you say its name, Gary, all you'll do is hex it. You will bring it to its knees, you will atrophy its muscles. Please, Gary, don't tip Brexit in the 2019 in Brussels. Please don't tip my racehorse, it's absolutely vital. And that, dear listener, finishes this Wigmore Hall recital.
Thank you very much.
Richard Stilgay.
I follow that, Gary, with some
Why do I bother? good morning.
Just give us the racing tips, that's all we want.
Our morning headlines. Lewis Hamilton was second fastest in practice behind Daniel Ricciardo for tomorrow's Mexico.
The time is 21 minutes to 8. Well, you all have heard there, we are broadcasting in front of an audience in the Wigmore Hall in London today to mark our 60th anniversary. Now, over the years, our programme has featured some of the most distinctive voices in broadcasting. And a fair few partnerships as well. Some, of course, which work better than others. Well, some of those friends and former colleagues are with us here this morning. And Nick is down in the audience to talk to some of them. Nick?
I am indeed, because you look round the Wigmore Hall, there is an extraordinary number of famous faces here. And then faces that you don't recognise, but voices that you undoubtedly will. And if, like me, you've been listening to the Today programme since you emerged from the womb, it is the soundtrack of your life. Now, let's not introduce the next guest, because you'll know the voice as soon as you hear it. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know that voice, ladies and gentlemen, don't you? It is, of course, Charlotte Green, our newsreader. Now, the first thing you're told when you're a presenter is, don't banter with the newsreaders, Charlotte. But you became known not just for your beautiful voice and presentation, but for the odd giggle on air.
Yes, I did it twice in 28 years, which I don't think is too bad a strike rate. But the first time, I think I defy anybody not to get the giggles. I had to read out, or rather I heard the name, the splendid name, of the head of the armed forces in Papua New Guinea, Major General Sir Jack Twat. And that began to set me off, and unfortunately I had to follow that up with a story about a sperm whale. And then Jim, who was sort of snorting and guffawing at this point, then had to interview a man called Finley Spratt. And in the general mayhem of the moment, he called him Pratt. So we went from twat to sprat to prat in about 40 seconds, and all of us fell under the table at the end of it.
And in front of Charlotte, another voice. Let's just give you another experiment here. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know that voice, ladies and gentlemen. Voice of Brian Perkins, of course. I don't think you ever did giggle on air, Brian, did you?
Well, I did actually, but not, I'm glad to say, on the Today programme, but I did have an unfortunate episode on a Midnight News Bulletin many years ago, but I won't go into the lurid details.
Was it a struggle at times?
Indeed, it was a struggle, but, for that moment, yeah, but it's not the, because, you know, being a newsreader, you're very much in a sort of straitjacket, you know, and if you, stray away from that role, everything comes a bit unstuck. So.
But what the audience here at the Wigmore Hall are discovering is people come and go out of the studio on the stage here. There's quite a lot of laughter, a lot of hand gestures, lots of people working behind the scenes. It's quite hard for you to keep your composure.
Well, it is. I mean, and a lot of the jokes and things, of course, happened when the microphone was off. Thank goodness they didn't happen when they were on the air. But all the things that went on behind the scenes, you know, when we were waiting, when, you know, people, a recorded piece was on, you know, that was the time you could have jokes. But then the red light came on and you had to be, you know, decorum.
The red light came on and you heard another voice you will recognise.
And a very good morning to you.
Peter Hobday, of course. Peter, good morning to you. No two presenters can ever be together without talking about one subject, sleep. Do you still wake up?
Well, I have to say this morning I once again woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I have done for the 20 years since I left the programme. Now the nice thing is I don't wake up with a four-letter expletive. as the body struggles to get out of bed and face the day. Now I have a seraphic smile on my face. I turn over and usually go back to sleep, except this morning, because I knew I was coming here to do a quick turn with yourself.
Now, you know, I said it was the soundtrack of my life, your life, in my case, because Brian Redhead was the father of my best friend. You worked with him for all those years. Lively, I imagine.
He was a great man. I have to say, I was in absolute awe of working with Brian, because he kind of knew everything there was to know about presenting the Today programme. He was the Today programme in those days. But what I also remember about him was his demanding nature, both of his colleagues and of producers, and his use of quite strong language if he wasn't getting the stuff that he wanted. And the other thing I remember is I was there at that time when we moved from the old technologies of sort of mechanical typewriters, fixed lines and the rest of it. Brian kept his mechanical typewriter right to the end, insisting on his own production secretary, who had to take the stuff from his typewriter and actually put it into the system. And I remember this wonderful idea is that Brian, although he faced the future, could not give up on the past technology.
Today's presenters are a pushover in comparison, he says, looking at the stage. Now, we've been talking a lot about Gary's racing tips, and there is a man to blame here. It wasn't Gary's idea. It was Alan Ashton, deputy editor of the programme in the 1970s. Morning.
Good morning. Well, I was part of the team that brought Redhead and Timpson together. I was also in charge of the newsroom the night we entered the Common Market. But what have I remembered for? Racing tips.
You owe the country a lot of money, if I may say so.
Well, we decided we were revamping Today, and I suggested we had racing tips. And everybody said, you won't get away with it. You won't get away with it. You'll never be able to do it. But I knew something they didn't. That the Director General, Ian Trevithan, who'd previously been in charge of radio, was called a meeting and said, we'll put the input into Today. So there I was before the head of religious broadcasting, the head of arts, the head of everything. And I started to explain that in the 5 minute sports slot, we'd have two tips called Today tips.
We've been losing money ever since, Alan, forgive me. As they often say on this programme, we've run out of time. Thank you very much indeed. John.
Thank you very much indeed, Nick. 7:45. Now, at this time on a Saturday morning, we introduce Meet the Author. The author, Jim, has already talked to, but it's not a normal Saturday, of course. So, Jim is here, live in the Wigmore Hall, and so is his author, Jim.
Morning, John. I thought I was here to play the piano, but never mind.
Ah, he does, you know. He does.
Very nice to be here, and it's my great pleasure to introduce to you all Monica Alley, one of our most celebrated novelists of recent times. And Monica, we can talk about your life in general, but
thank you very much, Jim. And now at 7:58, as you would expect, it is time for Thought for the Day. And with us in the Wigmore Hall this morning, a man who's been doing it for, I think it's 33 years.
33 exactly.
Wow. Bishop James Jones.
Good morning, John. I was 9 when the Today programme began. There's a piece of news from those days that still haunts me. In the last bulletin before 8 o'clock, the announcer intoned that a prisoner who'd been sentenced to death would be hanged at 8 a.m. Then, just minutes later, came the news that he'd been executed. I kept thinking, what if he's innocent? What fear must he be feeling on his way to the gallows? It was my first experience of the connection between news and empathy. 60 years ago was a different world. The history of today is a history of our times, capturing decades of debate.
Over the past 60 years, we've become part of our listeners' morning routines. I can't tell you how often people have told me, I shower with you every morning. We are the soundtrack of your breakfast, and commuters know that they have to have left the house by Thought for the Day or the racing trips if they're to make the train. But if that's been part of our role for the past 60 years, what about 60 years hence? Will radio still even be relevant?
Well, Naomi Clymer is president of the Institution of Engineering and Technology. She actually started her engineering career at the BBC, possibly getting us on air. Katie Adamson is the CEO of Future Nautics, and both have been imagining how rapidly changing technology will change what we do and what you do as you listen. And Naomi Clymer, can you give us a sort of canter through what a morning routine would look like and possibly sound like in, well, I mean, 60 years hence seems too far. 30 years hence?
Okay, so I'd say many of us will be living in cities more than today because we'll want to be part of that very connected infrastructure. So we'll be in a smart home. Our home's going to wake us up at a time that it's figured out from our diary when's a good time. It's also looking at our biorhythms to make that decision. We're probably not going to be preparing for a commute to work. There's a lot of talk about the future of work. What sort of jobs are we going to have when everything's automated and artificially intelligent? So if you have got work, it'll probably be some sort of virtual work, so you'll be doing it in the virtual domain, and actually you'll probably be living a lot in virtual reality as well. So you'll probably have breakfast with your family, but that may be in a holographic kitchen where you don't actually live with them anymore. And I guess you'll be surrounded by smart healthcare as well, so you'll have sensors all over your body that will be monitoring your health, and you'll be proactively presented. Perhaps you'll have a 3D printer that will print out a day's prescription for you based on exactly what's happening in the moment. And I'm pretty sure certainly in 60 years and maybe even in 30 that we'll have begun to settle on another planet as well, so this programme may well have a correspondent on Mars.
Kate Adamson, is that your scenario?
I'm going to violently agree with most of that, actually. The issue we have with the future now is how fast it's coming at us, and that's as a result of the exponential growth of these breakthrough technologies. So to give you an understanding of what we mean by that, a technology which has 1% of the market today in 7 years could have 100% of the market. So it's very difficult to say by 2030 we'll be doing X and Y. We could be doing that by 2020. Certainly by 2070, whatever it will be, in 60 years' time, we will probably be walking around with brain-computer interfaces, so we won't all be sitting in an audience here. We'll just think to each other.
Okay. Well, so will we be, as far as radio, obviously, we'd like to know that we might still be around. It's going to, and you think back that people used to gather around one set and now they've got earbuds. Can you imagine how we presumably will be listening to the radio then?
We probably don't have language now for the way we will be living our lives in 60 years' time. We have to understand we're going to do things we've never been able to before. We're going to reprogram our own biology. We're going to manipulate matter at a molecular level, and we are going to create a greater than human non-biological intelligence. We are going to redefine what it means to be human.
Okay, I just wanted to know if the pips would still exist.
Listen, I know the worry everyone has, and that is how are we going to know to brush our teeth if we don't have Gary Richardson doing the sport? It's like I reassure you, we will be able to upload his consciousness, and you will all be able to have your own personal Gary Richardson bot.
We will still have our teeth.
And we self-cleaning, of course.
Well, we'll be able to switch him off, though, won't we? Naomi Clymer, for that view of the future, and I suppose as far as radio is concerned, because obviously we have an interest, we'll be hearing it in our head if we want to. We'll be, having guests live. We'll be able to teleport them into a studio to be in front of us. How do you see it working?
Yeah, I agree. I think it is entirely possible that you'll be hearing the programme in your head, and it probably won't be a programme in the same sense. But what I would say is, you know, since cave paintings and probably before that, we've been telling stories, including the stories behind the news. And so I'm pretty confident that some form of stories behind the news will still be going on in 60 years' time.
Naomi Clymer, Kate Adamson, thank you both.
And it is 8:01, and here is Philip Avery with the weather. Phil.
John, in the finest of traditions for the Today programme, we have no time for the weather as ever. The only thing I do want to say today, and I know that's what you've come for, really.
Always complaining.
Yes. The one thing that I would say across the northern parts of the British Isles today is the strength of the wind.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 28th of October. Welcome to a 60th anniversary edition of the Today programme, live from the Wigmore Hall in London. In the next hour, John Humphreys will be grilling two Westminster big beasts on how political interviews have changed over the years. Turner Prize-winning sculptor Sir Anish Kapoor will be talking about the relationship between culture and British identity. And Sue McGregor will be exploring what keeps Today programme presenters going first thing in the morning. The BBC News is read by Corrie Caulfield.
The Spanish government has started imposing direct rule on Catalonia after the regional parliament declared independence. 9 members of crew on a Royal Navy nuclear submarine have been dismissed for failing drugs tests. Jeremy Corbyn will say a warped and degrading culture which tolerates the abuse of women is thriving at Westminster.
The time is now 8:10, and it is the slot traditionally reserved on this programme for the big political interview. The moment you've all been waiting for, or perhaps the moment half of you switch off. So, on this special anniversary programme, we must obviously respect the tradition. But instead of us telling the politicians what we think of them, or at least their policies, we're going to give them a chance to say what they think of us. And this whole business of trying to hold the politicians' feet to the fire. And they are Neil Kinnock, former Labour Party leader, now Lord Kinnock, of course, who first appeared on this programme we were just talking about nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, just about.
Yeah. And, relatively speaking, therefore, obviously, a new boy, Michael Gove, Cabinet Minister, and a former reporter on this programme. So, Michael, downhill ever since, really.
Well, yes, I think, like a lot of young people, I started out well by working on this programme, then I fell in with the wrong crowd. they were called the Notting Hill set, George, Dave, others, and very soon after I fell in with them, I became addicted to think tank papers and policy discussion, and then it was all downhill from there.
And power, you became addicted to power.
Well, some people would say that my behaviour suggested that I have a love-hate relationship with power.
Quite so. Let's... That was not meant to be a comment, Tom.
No, I think it touched the nerve.
You don't look too rattled. That'll be the day. Now, look, let's talk about this interview. First of all, Neil, is it a necessary thing, rather than a good thing, is it necessary that we interview people like you in the way that we do in order to further to help the democratic process? Is it important?
Yes, especially when we've got the privilege of being on the slot of state. That's the 8:10 interview on the Today programme. I mean, that really doesn't get any better than that.
Only
Desert Island Discs is a greater honour. but yes, it is important that you do it in the way that you do it. And we know that for two reasons, because you really do, on many days, help to, awful phrase, set the agenda for what follows from it. Secondly, the number of broadcasters across the world, not just this country, that seek to emulate what the Today programme does, and I'm not flattering now.
Well, I was going to say, no more flattery.
But it's the privilege of the old John to be able to give and take flattery, so I would exchange
all
the
right.
Attitude.
Well, thank you for that. But look, a lot of people, many people perhaps in this audience, believe that we are too tough on you, that we, good heavens alive, even interrupt you occasionally.
The age of deference in broadcasting politics died a long time ago, I'm very happy to say. Tell me, Prime Minister, is there anything else you'd like to say? Thank God we don't hear any more of that. But there are occasions irritating for the listeners, not so much for the person being interviewed, when incisiveness, determination, assertiveness necessary by the interviewer does trip over into too frequent interruption. It's impossible to find the perfect balance, so I sympathise with you on that, even though I've been on the receiving end.
Michael, what about you? Are we too, I would say, too hard on you guys?
No, I don't think so. I think that we deserve it in a way, because you mentioned power earlier. We have a responsibility. We spend billions of pounds worth of public money. We pass laws which curtail people's liberty and force them into particular courses of action. And therefore we have to be held responsible for those decisions. Now, the House of Commons holds us responsible in some ways, but actually we've got to be realistic that the House of Commons is not the only cockpit where we are held to account. The Today programme is critically, along with lots of other programmes. And one of the things that vindicates the Today programme and the approach you take is simply the number of people who tune in every morning. If what you were doing was contemptuous of democracy, and if citizens thought that it was nonsensical and unnecessarily aggressive, they'd switch off.
But isn't there a danger, God forbid, that we make and we don't set out to do this, we really don't, but occasionally perhaps we make a politician look silly, or perhaps the politician makes themselves. I said perhaps. Makes themselves look silly, or contemptible in some way. And is there a danger then that you are diminished in the eyes of the public, and that's damaging to the process?
Well, I know what you mean. Sometimes I think that coming into the studio with you, John, is a bit like going into Harvey Weinstein's bedroom.
I tell you what,
you've got something else to say there, Michael.
John goes way past groping.
No.
Way past groping.
You just pray that you emerge with your dignity intact. But the broader point is that, yes, you can make a fool of yourself. And sometimes, of course, because, you know, you and other interviewers are highly skilled, trained. You've been up since 3 o'clock in the morning, read all the papers, been briefed expertly by the producers and researchers who often don't get enough credit and notice.
Yeah.
You are in a position, therefore, sometimes, if we're underbriefed, which we sometimes can be, or if we're in the middle of some, you know, omni-shambles, you're able to so painstakingly expose that it is painful to listen to and bruising to be part of. You know, that's part of democracy.
You've been on both sides. I mean, you've been a journalist and you've been a politician. How would you change it? How would you this business of interviewing politicians? What changes would you bring about if you had the power? You will perhaps one day. Who knows? You'll come back.
I don't know. Well, I think there's one change that I'd like to see, but I think it's difficult to sort of mandate. And that is, I think that there's slightly too much interest in the soap opera of politics. Mm. Who's up, who's down, who's mates with whom. An insufficient focus on policy. If I think about some of the
policy things... Policy is about people.
Well, politics is always about people, and people's motives matter, and their decisions have to
and
be...
their behaviour.
But, you know, if you have programmes like the Troubled Families programme, or if you have decisions to give money to people like Camilla Batman-Gellidge, now, these are decisions that we made in government that I think probably didn't receive enough scrutiny in comparison to some soap opera questions that understandably preoccupied people.
Neil, you got a lot of personal... Well, inevitably, when you say, I want to be Prime Minister, you're going to get it. You got a lot of personal abuse. Too much?
Sure, but not from this programme, or indeed from broadcasters in general. And I once said... that if I could choose a country to live in, it would be in Radioland. Because I think actually in terms of the mixture of seriousness and daftness of humour and gravity, and in terms of fairness, balance, penetration of issues, although Michael's right about trying to get this balance of policies and personalities, then radio is by far the superior way for democracy to conduct itself.
How would you change it, though?
I don't think I'd change it a lot, certainly not from Radio 4. And that's not being... I'm not trying to be ingratiating. It's all too late for that.
Oh, don't mind. No, you carry on. But, it's lovely to hear. Make such a change.
But I can't think of all that many improvements, except possibly... some greater addition of analysis programs, and I'm not speaking with a capital A of the Radio 4 program, but analysis programs that could give a detailed treatment, not over an exhaustive length, but certainly over 10 minutes, to issues, policies, purposes, motivations, rather than just step into the jungle of personalities. The thing is, what's occurred, of course, because of your supervision and your examination, is that you are partly responsible, I'm not speaking only of John Humphreys, obviously, partly responsible for the development, I won't call it the invention, of spin.
Ah.
It's become necessary, as you've managed to tread on our landmines, as it were, for politicians to try subsequently to manage the news by what's now called spinning.
Interesting thought that, Michael, that we've kind of gone down that road and you had to follow us, as it were. What do you think is the difference that this sort of interview, that the political interview, has made to politics?
Well, I think overall it's meant that politicians have been kept more honest. I think that the knowledge that You can't be a frontline cabinet minister or you can't be a principal opposition spokesman without exposing yourself to detailed questioning on a platform that commands the attention of millions of people means that, you know, Neil is right, there is always the temptation for politicians to attempt to elide truths and to use spin to emulsify what's going on, but actually you cut through that, and that is valuable. Now, it's sometimes painful, and sometimes you want to resist being exposed at particular points because we're in the middle of changing from a bad situation to a better one, and the bad situation being exposed can sometimes embarrass and weaken us as we're trying to change something, but on the whole, it's a force for good.
Don't forget...
Sorry. They've just come into my ears and said... I was just going to say,
illusion, evasion, football managers, businessmen, trade unionists, scientists, everybody does that. Everybody.
Even sometimes BBC executives.
No, we must stop it at that point. Do you know what? First time I've ever interviewed, probably in the last couple of years, I haven't talked about Brexit, Michael. There we are. Thank you both very much indeed. Neil Kinnock and Michael Gove. Thank you both.
Well, perhaps the biggest highlight over the past 60 years was the 2012 Olympics. Former London Mayor Boris Johnston is with us. It was simply fantastic.
Well, yes, you know, and come on. You know, it definitely unearthed a new tranche of unforgettable sporting heroes. Mo Farah, Jessica Ennis, the long jump chappie, the Browning brothers. Brownlee brothers, yes, thank you. Claire Balding, Tom...
But Boris, you didn't actually bring the games to London, did you?
Well, but come on, let's be absolutely clear about this. I went to Beijing to kind of pick them up, you know, in a big double-decker bus, if you remember, so...
But you were nothing more than a mascot for 2012, really, without the baggy suit and the shaggy head, obviously, or actually, with both of those things. Didn't you take just all the glory that should have been Ken Livingstone's?
Hey, now, come on, little fella, this is getting harder than an interview with that Rottweiler Humphreys.
Well, that's finally got John to sit up and listen to my sport bulletin.
Now you know how much I value your sport, Gary. It's my chance to nip out to the toilet. Talking of which, back in five.
Well, over the past 60 years, David Beckham has been one of the world's most respected sports stars, and it seems only fitting that he should give us this special thought for the day.
The great Socrates, the philosopher, not the former Brazil number 10, once said... The only true wisdom is in knowing that you know nothing, which makes me very wise. But I did once think in my wisdom that having a tattoo made you a better person, that it made you an artist. Well, now I know having a tattoo doesn't make you an artist. It makes you an easel.
Thank you, David. Well, For much of the past 60 years, British tennis has had little to shout about. Then came along a young lad called Andy Murray. I first interviewed Andy when he was 15, and I've been doing it ever since. Good morning, Andy.
Yeah, hi, Gary. Hi.
You're renowned for your battling performances. You like a good fight, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, to a point, but sometimes, you know, you're exhausted, you've given your all for like 5 hours or something, and then the real probing starts, you know, trying to find your weaknesses, hitting you while you're down, you know, you feel everything you've done just counts for nothing.
And that's how you feel playing Novak Djokovic, for instance?
No, it's how I feel when you interview me, Gary.
Well, some of the nation's favourite voices have been part of this programme, as we've heard earlier. Charlotte Green have gone on to read the football results from Five Live, and former newsreader and reader of the shipping forecast, Brian Perkins. And Brian, as we know, is here today. But Brian, did you ever secretly yearn to do the football scores?
Well, I'm not really a football fan. Charlotte Green knows and loves the game. I'd probably have said Arsenal 1, Manchester United 4, possibly 5 later, generally good. Lundy, Tuesday, Sheffield Wednesday 1, Leeds United 2, rising slowly, Manchester City 6, Stoke Rockall.
Looking out into our audience, it's great to see one of my literary heroes, Alan Bennett. Alan, I didn't know you were a sports lover.
I'm not.
John told me, though, you wanted to speak about sport.
Well, I wanted to say that it's perhaps typical if I'm... typical of anything, Radio 4 listener. I don't really want to know about sport over my porridge or over anything else, come to that. I can go elsewhere on what they insist nowadays on calling the network for that. Why don't you, Gary, give me something at 5:20 past the hour that I am interested in? The theatre news, for example.
How would that work, then?
Well, you'd say, I can't do the voice. Dame Judy Dench has failed a late fitness test on an injured ankle and will not be appearing as Queen Anne in Richard III at the Globe tonight. Her part will be taken by her understudy, Romelu Lukaku.
Well, I'll put it to the editor. Alan, thank you very much. So, 60 years of Today's Sport, how do we sum it all up? Who better to ask than former Today presenter, Sir Michael Parkinson?
60 years of sport is a collection of great memories, of legendary names, of people doing superbly well. What doesn't really matter? Muhammad Ali, George Best, Mary Peters, Bobby Charlton, Virginia Wade, Henry Cooper, Rebecca Adlington, Jeffrey Boycott, the list goes on. The sport goes on and on. Gary Richardson goes on and on and on. This day will become tomorrow, but today will always be today.
Michael, thank you very much. And that was Alistair McGowan, impressionist. Alistair McGowan, ladies and gentlemen. Alistair McGowan, impressionist and now a pianist. And Alistair's new voice, and he was practising it earlier down the line to me, he does a brilliant impression of Joanna Lumley. So I will now ask Alistair, as Joanna Lumley, to read the racing tips.
Cheltenham, 1 o'clock, number 10, doing fine.
Do better than this.
3:45, number 4, Thomas Campbell.
Do you know anything about horses?
I didn't hear that.
Joanna Lumley, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It is now 27 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Sarah Montague, John Humphreys and Corrie Caulfield with the news.
Demonstrators calling to Spain to remain united are expected to gather today in central Madrid to protest against Catalonia's declaration of independence. Well, that's the news. Now, here's Michelle Hussein.
Corrie, thank you. It's 25 to 9. How has global power shifted in the 60 years that this programme has been on air? Beyond our borders in 1957, Eisenhower was the US president. Mao was in power in China.
The time is now 20 minutes to 9. We have the privilege of interviewing many remarkable people on this programme. But I have to say that one of the more memorable guests that I've ever interviewed was last year. She was 11. She is Alma Deutscher, a composer, pianist and violinist who's become known as Little Mozart. A year ago, her opera Cinderella premiered in Vienna to critical acclaim. And she has kindly composed something for our birthday and is here on the stage in the Wigmore Hall.
60 today, but still raring to go. 60, but still the best radio show. Walk through the night, up at first light. Always on cue to keep us in the know. Raise a glass to this radio show. Today you're the star of the studio. Oh, now with one voice, let all of us say, long live the pips and the thought for the day. Here is to you, all fresh and new. Here is to 60 more years of today.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 12-year-old Alma Deutscher. Alma, thank you so much for that. Now, that, of course, was perfect, sublime radio, but any listener to Today will know that we don't always get it right. There are a number of occasions when things have not always gone to plan.
And the time now is 25 minutes to 7. 8. Past 7. Got it wrong. Everybody's waving their arms at me. 25 past 8. 7. Why can't I get it right?
Thank you very much, Steve. I'm going to interrupt.
Well done.
I got stuck in the loop. I'm sorry.
And I've been talking to Tony Benn, who, of course, served as Secretary of State in a Labour government. He has often criticised the United States in the past. I asked him what he made of this. Oh, dear. I'm sorry. We obviously have a problem there. That was the wrong, because they're rather bizarrely. But I don't know whether we can find this.
General Singerock's unpopular replacement has now been dismissed, with the Army's popular Chief of Staff, Jack Twatt, taking over.
A 40-foot sperm whale, which was stranded in the Firth of Forth for more than 4 days, is now thought to be swimming towards open waters again. It freed itself late last night. Marine experts are hoping to establish this morning whether the whale is finally back at sea.
Well, first up after the news, we're going to be talking to Jeremy Hunt, the Culture Secretary, about broadband.
A look back there at some of our not very glorious moments. Look, any look back of almost any sector is not going to be complete without a woman, a former presenter of this programme and a friend, who really knows how to take a look back and reconsider things that have happened in the past. Famous for the reunion, Sue McGregor has her own little mini reunion now, Sue.
Sarah, thank you very much. I have to say, during that famous moment for Charlotte, that we heard about sperm whales and everything, I was laughing so much, I was with Jim in the studio, that I had to run out, and it led to a rumour sweeping round the building that Jim and I had had a terrible row. But I just rushed out of the studio because I was laughing so much. Anyway, Neil Kinnock was talking earlier about analysis on today, and I've got, I think, just under 10 minutes to try and analyse what it was like to be on today or to work for it, and how it's changed with... Next to me, Sally Thompson, who worked for Today in its very early days in the 1950s. Libby Purvis over there, who was the first regular woman presenter of Today in the 70s. And, yes, what's in
Humphreys,
the...
Humphreys.
Thank you. John Humphreys, who's been presenting Today since 1987 and here with their thoughts on how the programme has changed. Let me start with you, Sally, because Neil Kinnock, sitting where I'm sitting now, a few... minutes ago, talked about the importance of more analysis on the Today programme. What was it like in your early day, when you were a young thing?
Well, I don't think we had any analysis. on the whole, it was a magazine programme. If you think of the present Today, then as a newspaper of the air...
Well, it certainly wasn't hard news.
Absolutely not. No, there was the news bulletin, which was followed usually by something called Programme Parade.
Whatever that was.
Which was trails for forthcoming programmes. And then Today started.
But you had quite an important role, and I was interested to... You told me that you had actually been a sort of transatlantic correspondent by virtue of being on a liner heading for New York. And in those days, we're talking about 1958, I think... you were able to get in touch with Broadcasting House and give a little report.
Yes, well, Isa Benzi, who was the first organiser of the Today programme.
Famous woman in radio,
yes.
In her day.
You know, she was called the organiser, not the editor, because she was obviously a woman.
Yes, she couldn't be an editor.
Anyway, she wanted to do something different, and I'd been a producer... on Radio 4, but I had just
home
got married.
Service.
Yes, home service, sorry. And I had just got married, and I was going to America to join my husband, who'd got a job there. And he said, Isa Benzi said, why don't you broadcast every morning from the ship about life on a transatlantic liner, and that's what I did.
Which you did. And you were in the position of working for a programme that then almost repeated itself between 7 and 8 and 8 and 9. There were two separate halves of Today.
Yes,
second half was, it was rather important for people like you to be on it because you got paid twice.
Yes, that was very exciting. You got there in the morning and you did your little piece it was usually about a little talk of about 3 minutes, and then you hung around a bit hoping that they would say, stay till the next time, and because if you did, you got paid the full amount a second time.
Which was?
Oh, about £5.
I'm surprised it was as much as that.
Yes.
But anyway, now Libby, let us spool forward to the 1970s. You are famously the first woman presenter to have stuck it out on the Today programme. And you were incredibly young then, in your mid-20s?
28, yes, I'm still the youngest person
of either sex.
And so they could exploit me rotten. I did 2 days a week alongside Brian Redhead and 2 days alongside John Timpson. So they only had to meet on Wednesdays because they didn't like each other much at first. After I left, they became a very good duo. But the programme had moved on. It was actually very similar to Today, with a few kind of key differences. Like there was a rule that no interview, even if it was with the Prime Minister, went on longer than 7 minutes. That was it. 7 minutes. And we also had a lot more regional voices. We had a lot more stuff in from local radio stations and from regions and reporters, which I was before I was a presenter. We'd be sort of sent off to beat up a region. They would say, Libby, go off to East Anglia and see if there's anything happening there, because we haven't had anything from there for a while. So I would go off and do the Wisbeach floods and stuff.
And
like
there
that.
Were regional opt-outs too. And but Libby, you always seem to me to be an incredibly confident person. You still are. So when I joined Today, I felt really, look at those heads turning round, my goodness, from colleagues. I felt really quite nervous, but you never did on air.
Well, you know what, I think it's because I used to go sailing, and I still do, and you sort of think, well, if I mess things up, nobody's going to be drowned, are they? You're not putting tubes up premature babies' noses, you know. You're not in a serious job like that. So the worst thing that's going to happen is you look like a bit of a tit, if I may say that word. Now, John, this is basically going to happen to you.
I'm still struggling with the idea of you being nervous. I can't quite...
Well, it's, you know, it's ducks, you know, they're smooth on top and lots of paddling going on under.
No, I think it's, you know, it was a fascinating, I mean, it's an exciting job because you are first up in the morning with a story to tell. And it's like being a small child that looks out of the window at six as it snowed.
Yeah.
And you get to run around the entire house going, it snowed, everybody.
Brian Redhead called it having a word in the ear of the nation. It still is. But John, you and I worked together from 1987. Mm. I was a sort of veteran by then.
You were.
You were a new, on the BBC One, a top newsreader. How?
Yes, I read an auto cue. Yeah, I know.
No, I didn't mean
no,
that
no,
way.
No. You'd have been right if you had dismissed
it. I think you once said to me that radio is more challenging than having a camera in front of you.
Infinitely more challenging. Well, look, I read an auto cue. Admittedly, you wrote the words that appeared on the auto cue, but that's what you do when you read the news. Basically, you read an auto cue. Maybe you introduce other people and ask them the odd question. But on the Today programme, you actually have to do a wee bit of thinking occasionally. Not all the time, but quite often. Infinitely different. Terrifying. I was absolutely scared witless.
Well, I never saw a sign of it.
Oh.
I was quite terrified of you, but I have to say, somebody was talking earlier about typewriters, and you and I were part of that, the era of the typewriter in the Today office. Especially on that day of the hurricane, because I thought afterwards, years afterwards, thank goodness we weren't computerised, because we had no power. But somebody mentioned Brian Redhead passing on, typing out his, on an ancient typewriter, a particularly ancient one, his script. Now, I often benefited, or that's quite the wrong word, from Brian not having typed anything at all. Somebody would call him out of the Today office and say, quick, do a prereq with Washington or, you know, Beijing or somewhere. And, Sue, you do Brian's next item. And I said, but there's nothing, it's just a blank page here. He hasn't typed a thing. So I used to borrow occasionally from what Brian used to do, which was take a newspaper, read the first four lines of the story I knew I was going to cover and hope for the best.
Well, we've all been there, haven't we? Yes, quite. I mean, often you don't have a script at all. Obviously, stories break late, and often you make a complete porridge of it and hope nobody's noticed.
Mm.
I mean, that's the great joy, and I shouldn't admit to this, should I, but the great joy of a breakfast audience is you know that the vast majority of them have got other things to do while they're listening.
Well, that's the great thing about radio. It's carried about with
the great thing about radio. Yes,
Libby, it's interesting about Brian and the cues, because when we had a taped package, you know that really annoying thing where the presenter reads out a whole lot of facts and then actually the beginning of the tape is exactly the same facts again.
Oh yes.
Brian used to say the ideal cue just is hark.
Yes.
Libby, we mustn't forget that not only were you the first woman presenter on Today in the 70s, but you also did, and we heard a bit of it earlier, you did a live stint from Peking, it was still called in those days.
From Beijing. We'd learnt to call it Beijing by then. Yes, Aubrey Singer, who was head of radio, was obsessed with China, and he decided that one of the presenters should go out for a fortnight, collect a lot of material, and present the programme live from Beijing. And of course, we had a cubicle full of fascinated Chinese, because they weren't even allowed to do the news live. And there we were. And I had the unique opportunity of handing over to John Timpson with the Pope in Dublin and Brian Redhead at the Liberal Conference at Margate. It was the most exciting three-way we ever did. And I have to say, I mean, BBC engineers, we all love outside broadcasts, they're all making this work now. I mean, everything worked immaculately.
How wonderful.
Wonderful.
A quick question to you, Sally. You've listened to the Today programme, mm-hmm. presumably many, many, many hundreds and thousands even of time since you first worked on it or for it. How much do you think it's changed?
Oh, well, it's changed absolutely enormously. It's a different animal, absolutely. It's so sharp, so edgy. It's about everything that's happening today. And it's a wonderful way of getting up to speed with what's going on.
Well, happy birthday, 60-year-old today. And thank you, Sally Thompson, Libby Purvis, and John Humphreys. And it's nice to see Sarah Montague in the middle too.
Thank you, Sue.
The time is now 9:04. That is the sound of Command Warrant Officer Andy Knox at the submarine base at Faslane in Scotland, piping the side. It's usually heard when a senior officer leaves one of the boats, but he's playing it especially for us live today because of the special connection that this programme has with the country's nuclear deterrent. Now, you will have heard a story in the bulletins about the difficulties there have been on one nuclear submarine, but our more usual link is rather different, and if anything, we'd like to think that it proves how important and influential we are at Today. It was something that was dug up by the historian Lord Hennessy, who was once a Today guest editor, and he's with us here on the Wigmore Hall stage. Good morning to you.
Morning, Sarah.
Talk us through this bizarre idea that this broadcast is actually preventing nuclear war.
Well, in the mid-90s, I discovered that one of the tests that the submarine on continuous patrol has to do, heaven forbid, if there's reason to think that Britain is a smoking and irradiated ruin after a preemptive nuclear strike, is to try and get the Today programme. And if they can't get the Today programme, there can't be a Britain left. It's quite simple, the calculation. And allowing for Sundays, of course, allowing for Sundays. And I remember I came on, and it was John and Sue. And a discussion followed about which of you, John or Sue, would go into the bunker with the Queen to do the broadcast.
I lost.
You didn't want to do it, actually. What we didn't know then, well, it wasn't a bunker for the Queen, it was the Royal Yacht. So a floating bunker, hiding in sea locks off the northwest of Scotland. But that was the discussion that ensued. I remember it was 96. And when I was guest editing in December 2007, I interviewed the commander of the base, the commodore of the base, Mark Beverstock, and he confirmed the story that indeed the Today programme was a vital element in the firing chain of the ultimate weapon of last resort. And it seemed to excite Today. It certainly excited John and Sue. I remember when the story broke in 96.
Well, and not surprisingly, and whether it's still the case, it seems extraordinary.
It's certainly still the case.
Lord Hennessy, thank you very much.
And finally, I have to tell you, our editors were Dave McMullen, Imogen Walford and Laura Cooper, and many other thanks to all of the producers who make this programme possible. But above all, a huge thank you to you, our listeners, the beating heart of Today for so many years. Some of you have been listening from day one, some of you have just joined us, and now there are more than 7 million of you. You don't always approve of what you do, but we thank you very much for listening. Yes, we listen to what you have to say. You have been fantastically loyal. You are the Today program. So, from all of us to all of you, thank you for listening. Good morning.